Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. Thank you very much.
Before
Good
we
morning.
Dive into the headlines and the topic for today, I want to say congratulations, and this is hard for me to do this. Congratulations on your Boston Red Sox winning the World Series.
Thank you very much, David. That's very, very gracious of you being a Yankee fan. I will say that of the four World Series they've won in my lifetime, 2004, I was, of course, very historic, ending the 86-year drought. I remember watching every game in 2004, staying up late in Edinburgh to watch those and being very, very excited and waking my son up to see them win. I frankly remember very little about the 2007 and 13 championships, but I would say this one is particularly dear to me because I'm in the U.S. right now, so I actually was able to watch it in normal time. But also, this is a much more likable team than the 2004. Here's a radical take, a hot take for our listeners. I think the 2018 team is much more likable than the 2004 team. Although the 2004 team holds a dear place in my heart. So thank you, David. That was very, very, very kind
well,
of you.
You know, if history is any record, Boston does very well in the first two decades of any century and then proceeds to not do well in the following eight decades. So we will see if that pattern follows.
Yes, so your Yankees will now win another 20 championships to end this century. But you know what? I won't be around in the next 86 years, so the timing's okay for me.
All right. I'm not quite sure how to transition from that to the headlines of this week. But
well, basically terrible news.
Yes. Now, this has been a really awful week in the headlines. We, of course, had a series of pipe bombs sent to at least 14 individuals last week, including George Soros, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, former Attorney General Eric Holder, Congresswoman Maxine Waters, and among others.
Cory Booker.
Exactly. The man responsible for which has been arrested in Florida. That all happened in the middle of last week, and then on Saturday there was the terrible shooting at the Tree of Life synagogue in Pittsburgh, in which 11 people were killed in a anti-Semitic attack. And also, and this is a story that has probably not gotten as much news coverage if it hadn't happened in the same week as these other things, in Kentucky last week, a man tried to break into a black church, and when he failed to do so, killed two African Americans in a Kroger in what is very clearly also a racially motivated killing. So, Frank, we wanted to see if we could provide some historical context for all these events, see what framework makes sense and what antecedents we can draw upon. What's your initial read on what all this means?
Oh, right. Well, first, I remember I was in a Facebook conversation probably about a week ago with some friends, and I was trying to provide some context and reassurance, saying, well, you know, yeah, things are bad right now, but we've seen nothing like the level of violence we saw, say, 50 years ago in our politics, and thank goodness we haven't got there yet. Well, That comment hasn't aged terribly well, because in the subsequent week we've had, as you very ably laid it out, this series of attempted bombings followed by two shootings that left 13 Americans dead that are clearly racially motivated or racial and anti-Semitic in nature, all against the backdrop of the midterm elections next week. It's a pretty bad time. There's no doubt about it. And I think I think we can kind of break these up in two ways. I think if we had recorded this last Friday before the terrible events in Pittsburgh on Saturday, you know, I was thinking about what we would talk about this week, and I thought, oh, we'll have to talk about political assassinations and attempted assassinations, because the bomb plot seems to have been the largest, or at least this was being reported on in the media, social and otherwise, was presented as the sort of biggest assassination plot in American history since the Lincoln assassination.
I don't think that's right, but anyway, we'll
Yeah,
get to
well,
that.
yeah, I know. Well, in fact, I think that's what we would have ended up discussing. But of course, we've moved on, so we have a new level of violence, and of course, we have 13 people killed in these two incidents in Kentucky and Pennsylvania, which are related but different. I think they're related in so far as I think there's a direct correlation between those events and the current political moment. I mean, both of the shooters in Kentucky and Pittsburgh seem to have been responding to the current perfervid atmosphere, particularly around immigration and race.
Frank, let's not beat around the bush here. Both all three of these incidents, I think, are connected by the participants' adherence to right wing media, both Fox News at all, and online and social media of various kinds.
That's right.
And by extension, the rhetoric that's coming out of, those media outlets and of the president, and I don't want to say the president's responsible for these in a direct way, but I think in an indirect way, the political climate that we're in right now that he has helped to create, is what is the shaping, architecture around all of these things.
Right. So that is the link. We go from attempted political assassination to random killings, although there's nothing random about the targets. The targets were deliberately chosen, but of innocent citizens who are not related to the political or not involved in politics, I should say. So I think there's two levels of violence here. There is we have kind of targeted violence or violence targeted at political leaders. In this case, they all happen to be Democrats. And violence aimed at racial and religious minorities. I agree with you completely, David. This is they're both products of this particular moment. I think there's no question about that. But I think they are slightly different in orientation, both worrying in their own ways. So I get you asked me for my general response. That would be my response. So I think there's kind of two threads to pick at here. One is the history of violence against politicians in the United States. The other is this kind of racial and sectarian violence with a political end. In terms of the latter, this feels a little bit like, and we've made lots of references to the late 19th century over the months in this podcast. I think that what we saw in Pittsburgh and what we saw in Kentucky was not unlike the politically motivated racial violence that one saw during Reconstruction. I'd be interested to hear your views on that.
There's a couple of acts of political violence during and after Reconstruction that this reminds me of, both of which in some ways are actually also tied to elections, and one of the ways in which white Southerners reestablished themselves as politically dominant in the South is through, they used all kinds of election chicanery and ballot stuffing and other kinds of tools, but they also used really profound levels of violence to both intimidate political opponents and to kill them. And the two events that came to mind when thinking about this, the first is the Colfax Massacre from 1873. This is an event that takes place in the small town of Colfax, Louisiana, and it happens in the aftermath of a contested election. There were Louisiana throughout Reconstruction had some of the most violent and contested elections and allocations of voter fraud and these kinds of things. And it culminated in the black political leadership in Colfax, the Republican leadership in Colfax, them claiming victory in the local elections and barricading themselves in the county courthouse in Grant County, which is where Colfax is the seat. And they are being surrounded by a huge number of white supremacist Democrats and Klans members and various other assorted paramilitary groups who then proceeded to fire into the courthouse after a two-week standoff. And more than 150 African-Americans died defending in some ways the integrity of the election, defending their both their rights as citizens and as elected officials. You know, what strikes me in thinking about this and you know, the Colfax massacre and the events of last week, one of the things that strikes me is the ways in which this political violence is working in conjunction with elections. And we think about the midterms happening next week, and I don't think those things are unrelated. The other event that really sort of struck me as a episode of really profound political violence that relatively few people know about is the Wilmington coup of 1898. Sometimes it's called the Wilmington Riot, sometimes it's called the Wilmington Massacre, but I think coup actually describes what it was more than anything else. The background to this is Wilmington, North Carolina, was one of the places in which the Republican Party maintained control throughout Reconstruction into the post-Reconstruction period, and you have a biracial Republican Party in control in Wilmington. And this happens in the context of a fairly virulent white supremacist campaign throughout the South, but in North Carolina in particular. And in the aftermath of an election, a white mob, which some people estimate as being 500 people, the details sometimes are hard to pin down, led by Alfred Moore Waddell, a former Confederate officer and white supremacist, basically raided the city, killing something on the order, and their estimates here vary pretty wildly, somewhere between a few dozen to a few hundred African Americans. Go in, they force the Republican city council to resign, and Waddell installs himself as mayor. And this is an attack that Waddell justifies. He says, look, we have a Republican Party in Wilmington that is irresponsible. There was a black newspaper editor, a guy named Alex Manley, who was publishing editorials that Waddell found offensive, and he used this as justification for toppling in a democratically elected government. And obviously, in both of these cases, the racial rhetoric and the violence and the politics are all part of the same schema.
I mean, that's all really, really helpful, David. I think there's a crucial difference. I mean, I think in broad terms, I agree with you. And I think we're seeing some real parallels with Reconstruction and its aftermath and the kind of violence and violent rhetoric we're seeing today, particularly aimed at disenfranchising non-white voters. Mm-hmm. I think that's the intention. So I think that's an area of overlap. I think there's a crucial difference in what we've seen in the past week, which is it appears that in these three terrible incidents, each of which is terrible in its own way, we had individuals more or less acting alone, although having engaged with the alt-right and white nationalists on social media, but they seem to have acted as individuals. In the case of the two shootings, of course, they were able to do so because the weapons that they had access to allowed them to do so. But unlike Wilmington, for example, the terrible shooting in Pittsburgh at the synagogue was an individual who went in. So we don't have
We
don't have groups yet. Yeah, we don't have paramilitary groups. That's not to say we don't have them, or that's not a threat. Yeah. But I think I think these incidents are different in that crucial respect. In fact, I think that's a problem because it's allowed President Trump supporters, if we can call them, to say, look, this is nothing to do with us. These were isolated, madmen or whatever, crazy people acting alone. How could you possibly blame this on us?
Well, so, my response to that, though, is I think people have started to pick apart the social media postings of some of the perpetrators of the past week. You know, they are part of a community of people, of like-minded individuals who are reinforcing certain perverse ideas online and are encouraging each other to engage in these kinds of activities. So in as much as they are, they're not, in some ways they are not the Unabomber, right? So they're not really, they're not socially isolated and alone in their thinking. They are part of a community of thinkers who are engaging in this.
Or they believe they are. I mean, so they're engaging in social media. I mean, you and I are on social media, not on the same social media they are, but there's an illusion of a community.
Yes.
But you turn it off and you go back and you do, you're in your real world, as it were. But it seems that these guys have been sucked in, and this has consumed a huge amount of their kind of bandwidth, if you will. I mean, the bomber, Caesar Sayoc, seems, the social media profile, his social media profile went from sort of posting about food and pictures of scantily clad women and MMA and things like this, to it took a turn a couple of years ago to being increasingly conspiratorial and kind of MAGA oriented, if you will, and white supremacist. So he seems to have kind of got sucked in. I mean, his background is interesting because I think his mother was a Filipino American and his dad was Italian American, but here he is embracing white supremacy. So that's just a weird aspect of this. But also he seems, there was the white van that I'm sure most of our listeners have seen pictures of, plastered in bumper stickers that were covered, invoking almost every conspiracy aimed at the Democrats that one can think of, and that was reflected in his targets. The other two shooters seem to have been, particularly the Pittsburgh shooter, seem to have been much more deeply engaged in the kind of more disturbing aspects of social media. And I had never heard of Gab before Saturday. Had you?
I had, but one of the things that struck me in terms of drawing parallels between the how these kinds of networks of ideas flow and how it creates this kind of violence. One parallel I saw was with the bombings and arsons of abortion clinics, especially in the 80s and 90s,
Yeah, I think this is more akin to that.
because I mean, one of the things you had happening and the data we have about the number of abortion clinics that have been attacked in the United States are really quite shocking. It's since abortion became after Roe versus Wade, we've got something in the order of 41 bombings, 173 arsons, a bunch more attempted bombings and arsons, and hundreds of bomb threats being leveled at abortion clinics. Seven abortion clinic workers have been murdered. Most recently, George Tiller in Kansas in 2009, and the Planned Parenthood attack in 2015. And the relationship between the attacks last week and the abortion attacks, I think, is you often, in the abortion attacks in the 80s and 90s, you had political leaders saying, look, abortion is murder. People are committing murder in abortion clinics. They are evil, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then an individual would hear that and act upon it by bombing the abortion clinic or engaging in other acts of violence. And then the leader would say, I didn't tell him to do that. I reject all violence. There's ways in which the political leadership class of the anti-abortion movement could simultaneously engage in rhetoric that, into some people's ears, was a call to violence, but at the same time say, look, that violence isn't us. We weren't involved in that. And it strikes me as a very similar parallel today with the way the Republican Party and the way that Fox News and other groups are saying, look, we didn't encourage the pipe bombs that were sent last week or the shootings in Kentucky or Pennsylvania. But on the other hand, it's clear that the people who are engaging in these acts are hearing those messages as calls to arms.
That's right. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the shooter in Pittsburgh said unequivocally that he was doing so in response to the attention that President Trump gave to this mi alleged migrant caravan coming from Central America through Mexico towards the United States. President, and we need to unpack that for a second. So that alleged caravan of migrants, many of whom may be seeking asylum, are that story was first picked up by, I think it was by Fox News, and then Donald Trump picked it up from Fox News and began running with it and began talking about it and has amplified it to the extent that it's agitated a lot of people among a lot of his supporters who see it as a threat, and we're hearing about either Middle Eastern terrorists being among the migrants and or that they're bringing diseases is the latest thing that we heard this morning. And so this threat has been amplified, and it was in response to that because the members of that the congregation at that synagogue were supporting migrants, and so there was a direct response to that. So I think that I think there's a direct correlation between the rhetoric being employed by the president and his supporters in this action. But you're right that his supporters, if we can say his more mainstream supporters in the media, have said, at least on Fox, look, this has nothing to do with us. We didn't say this. We're just reporting the news. And if somebody reached the wrong conclusion, well, what can we do about that? But it's disturbing because it is a bit like the abortion bombing campaign, where words have consequences, and I'm not sure President Trump appreciates that, but certainly some of the people around him appreciate that, and the people on Fox News appreciate that. And Lou Dobbs. I mean, Lou Dobbs is first of all, I can't believe he's still on television. And secondly, well, and sorry. I didn't want to tweet this because we shouldn't comment on people's appearances, but that is the worst dye job ever. Lou Dobbs has suddenly turned up with brown hair after 40 years. So Lou Dobbs on Fox Business Channel has been trafficking in the most outrageous conspiracies and pretty overt racism. President Trump is clearly watching this and engaging with it. And more importantly, or more dangerously, clearly, some of President Trump's supporters are also engaging with this, and we saw it came at a human cost last week in 13 people dead.
When it's not any accident that all the people that these bombs were sent to are people that Trump has specifically mentioned as being enemies of the people in the case of CNN or, the various things he said about Obama and Hillary Clinton and George Soros, in some only lightly veiled anti-Semitic language, and what have you. Whether Trump is engaging in this rhetoric with the intention of energizing this part of his base, I have no idea. But he should be. I'm hoping he's reflective enough to consider that that's something that's going on.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think he is? And I'm not trying to be facetious here. I think this is a really important question. Do you think President Trump appreciates the import of what he says, or does he just say it in the moment? I go back and forth on this.
I can't get in his head. I can barely get inside my own head, but I'm not sure he's fully aware of everything he's saying, and I'm not quite sure he's aware of all the ways in which some of the things he says are interpreted. I think he responds to positive the feedback he gets when he has these rallies, and I think. He goes for applause lines even if he's not entirely sure what the applause is about. For instance, he just only a couple of days before the bombings referred to George Soros as a globalist, which is a very lightly veiled but well-known anti-Semitic slur, that harks back to all kinds of conspiracy theories from the 19th century and other things. When he calls George Soros a globalist, does Trump fully understand the rhetorical meaning behind that? I don't. I am hoping, especially considering he has a Jewish daughter and a Jewish son-in-law, that he doesn't fully get what that means. And what the implications of it are, but that may be a generous reading on my part.
I think you might be right about that. And again, I'm not here to defend Donald Trump. Let me make that clear. But I'm not sure he necessarily appreciates the resonance of that word, and or more importantly, the kind of historic significance of that word. You know, so I think he sets globalist against nationalist. You know, when he declared himself a nationalist a week or so back, I don't think, you know, he didn't say the word white nationalist, and he didn't need to because his supporters heard what they wanted to hear.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I think he thought, well, of course I'm a nationalist, and globalism is at odds with nationalism. And of course, I understand that that binary has anti-Semitic implications, but I don't think he's aware of those.
Yeah, he may be dog whistling without aware that he's being fully aware that he's doing it.
That's right. Somebody's given him a dog whistle to blow in, and he just thinks it's a flute. I think he says reprehensible things, and I think he holds a set of reprehensible ideas. I'm not quite sure that he's necessarily aware of the significance of all the things he says. I think he responds to his audience and to what they respond to. And then once he starts, he just starts saying things off the top of his head, really. But that is not to excuse him, quite the contrary, because he's now been in office for nearly 2 years, and the evidence is quite clear that he has the ultimate bully pulpit and that the words of the President of the United States have meaning and are influential. Nikki Haley tweeted overnight, drawing a contrast between the way people responded to the shooting in Charleston a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, 2015, that terrible church shooting in Charleston when she was governor of South Carolina, and the shooting in Pittsburgh on Saturday. And she said, I don't think naively, I think deliberately, people didn't blame President Obama for the shooting in Charleston. Why are we blaming President Trump for the shooting in Pittsburgh? The obvious answer to that is, well, President Obama was not encouraging white nationalists either deliberately or inadvertently by his rhetoric in the way that President Trump seems to be. So, you know, the clear answer to me seems to be for President Trump, if he doesn't mean it, to say, look, if I've misled you or if I've sent the wrong message, I mean, he will never say this. I'm sorry. You know, that wasn't my intention. But he's incapable of saying that. And President Obama was doing nothing of the sort. So Nikki Haley was being disingenuous. I think she was being disingenuous deliberately. I interpreted that tweet to mean, yeah, she definitely has presidential aspirations and is trying to position herself in the post-Trump Republican Party without repudiating Trumpism exactly.
So, you know, thus far we've been talking about right-wing uses of violence for political ends. But the closest analogy to the pipe bombs that were sent last week is actually an act of left-wing, if anarchists are left-wing. It's hard to tell what anarchists are. Of anarchist bombings almost 100 years ago in 1919, where a very similar kind of attack happened. So in 1919, 36 mail bombs packed with dynamite were sent to a variety of political and business leaders, including Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, industrial magnates John D. Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan. And these were sent by American anarchists who were inspired by the philosophy of some Italian anarchists, and they mailed these bombs intended for them to be delivered on May Day, which of course has international implications for the anarchist movement and various left-wing movements. These bombs, turns out, didn't work. They managed, one of them blew up, but only managed to, only managed to wound a housekeeper, but the rest of the targets were not harmed. The post office intervened, much like they did last week, and were able to discover the rest of these bombs before they were delivered. But in response to this, the anarchist, a month later, delivered 8 much larger bombs that were left at the homes of some political leaders, including the Attorney General. And some of these did explode, including the one at the Attorney General's house, A. Mitchell Palmer. And this is actually one of the factors that led to the Palmer raids that year, in which the federal government targeted radical groups on the left.
Well, and let's not forget that a year later, you know, anarchists perpetrated the Wall Street bombing in September of 1920, which killed, I think it was 30 people and wounded 140 or something.
Yeah, I think it's 38 people killed. I think the 30 people died immediately, and then I think some people died subsequently of wounds. Most historians think those are the same group of anarchists that are doing all three of these bombings. Minor historical footnote about the second of the 1919 bombings. FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt lived down the street from A. Mitchell Palmer and had just walked by his house about 15 minutes before the bomb went off. So if you want an alternate history that could have, where things could have gone very differently, you can imagine what that would have been like. But these, you know, these anarchist bombings from 1919 and 1920 strike me as very similar to events last week, in as much as they are targeting both the political leadership class and they are targeting business leaders that they saw as being hostile to their interests. So just the same way that George Soros was among those targeted last week, you know, in 1919, they targeted Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan.
Right. So the list of targets is obviously different. Probably, presumably, we can't really map the political spectrum from a century ago onto today. But the fact is, there was a list of targets who were identified as seemingly antithetical to the beliefs of the organization or the individuals doing the bombing or sending the bombs. And so there's a parallel there. The other thing that I think bears we should bear in mind is this underscores the fact that this isn't very new in American history. There's a tendency, at least in the media, to say, you know, we've never been here before. This is not who we are, is the response we constantly read. I'm not, you know, you and I both know that's not the case. I mean, there's a long tradition of this. And during the subsequent years, bombings were used during the civil rights movement pretty consistently by opponents of civil rights, either to murder civil rights activists or to just indiscriminately sow terror in an effort to undermine the civil rights movement. So there's a long tradition of political bombings in the United States, which is not unlike that one sees in Europe from the late 19th century on.
Yeah. You know, in some ways, right now we're living I guess at the end of a period in which there was a relative paucity of political violence. I think, you know, after 1968 until last week, really, in some ways, we've not had this kind of political violence, at least on this scale. And so I think, you know, when people are saying that this is not who we are, I think that's not who they remember, what they remember American politics to be like. But if you look at sort of the long trajectory of American politics from at least, you know, the 1830s onwards, there's a very deep history of political violence, both people targeting, political leaders, political leaders targeting each other sometimes, people targeting symbolic targets with political motivations. If we were to go into an earlier phase to your time period, Frank, is there political violence of this kind in the colonial era or in the revolutionary era?
Yes and no. I mean, it's a much less violent. There's much less violence in terms of kind of interpersonal violence and violence against property than. You know, we associate with later periods. Having said that, we have to qualify this in a couple of major ways. First of all, there's massive violence being perpetuated against enslaved people and indigenous people, but that's not what you're asking about. I understand that. There is political violence in the sense that, I mean, one can interpret the American Revolution as a massive act of political violence. And people, you know, there was a huge amount of violence during the American Revolution, or in the run-up to the revolution, and during the revolution itself, perpetrated against people who disagreed or dissented. I mean, loyalists and people who wanted to remain neutral. And these people were physically intimidated, sometimes tortured and killed. I mean, and you know, thousands, 60,000 loyalists went into exile. If you ask them whether the revolution was violent, they would have, whether they were victims of political violence, they would have said yes. Afterwards, and our friend Joanne Freeman, who's coming to Edinburgh in the spring to give the Fennell lectures, written about this. Joanne has written about interpersonal violence between politicians in the, say, in the 1790s, so right after independence. And we know there was a dueling culture then, and a kind, and there were affairs of honor, as they were known, when politicians might engage in duels or fights. And most famously, Alexander Hamilton was killed by Aaron Burr. So that's always kind of the apotheosis of this violence. There was a fight on the floor of the House of Representatives in the, say, in the late 1790s. So there was occasional violence. It seems to have got worse, and Joanne's just got a new book out called The Field of Blood, which chronicles the violence in the antebellum period in Congress, and the kind of frequency and intensity of violent interaction seems to increase during your period as opposed to my
Oh, yeah.
period. But there's a culture of violence that I think can be traced back to the colonial period. I think we overstated it a little bit, because I do think it takes a turn for the worse in the 19th century, but I there is some violence and some political violence. What we don't have, apart from the revolution itself, and I realize that's a pretty big qualifier, is you don't have a lot of political killings that I can think of. I mean, did you have something in mind, or
Well, so I mean, I'm just thinking about the period before you have war breaking out. So the period from, the Stamp Act through, Lexington and Concord. You've got, I think, a lot of both symbolic violence, people being burned in effigy, and also actual violence.
people being tarred and feathered.
Which people, read about in textbooks, but that's, when you actually sort of piece apart what that actually is like and what it is to be tarred and feathered, that's a brutal kind of
It's
torture.
torture. It's torture.
And, with the threat in some ways of more violence embedded within it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that was what I was alluding to. I mean, I think there's a lot of coercion and physical intimidation during that period. There's a wonderful short story by Nathaniel Hawthorne. I don't know whether you've read it, called My Kinsman Major Molyneux, which is about this, and it's very, very good about it's the well it presents a kind of portrait of a pre-revolutionary mob and how it acted. And it's as is often the case with Hawthorne, there's a lot of kind of psychological insight in that story. I commend it to people if you're looking for something to read on this. But so during that decade, there was violence, and of course, it's been remembered as kind of patriotic resistance to British tyranny, which is a good way of kind of sidestepping the more violent and coercive aspects of that resistance movement.
Which are essentially, if you want to boil it down, are mobs and vigilantes engaging in extra legal violence. It that,
Yes. Yes, and because they're
burning down
so
people's houses and, attacking tax collectors and whatnot.
right, and because their side won, it's retrospectively sanctified.
To be sure. So, there does seem to be this amping up of political violence, at least if last week is any indication. What does this tell us about the state of American politics today that these kinds of events are happening?
Well, I think we'll better be able to answer that once we see the results on Tuesday. I mean, I think Trumpism represents, at some level, massive anxiety on the part of some Americans, not the majority of Americans. We have to remember that, but on the part of some Americans, particularly older white Americans, perhaps who aren't very well off economically, about the changes in the country and the demographic change is underway. And I think when President Trump talks about the migrant caravan, and when he talks about, where we're not going to discuss this in length today, eliminating birthright citizenship, which is his enthusiasm of this morning, we might get to this in a later episode, he's speaking to those anxieties. And I think the violence we're seeing so far has mainly been perpetrated by people who share those anxieties. Well, the change is coming, and I think that the kind of demographic change that makes them anxious, and there's nothing they can do to stop it. It's, you know, and the change is not coming in the form of that caravan of unfortunate people making their way through Mexico right now. The change is coming because the country's been changing for generations. And I think that the current Trumpism and the kind of violence we've seen arising from it, or parallel to it, are a response to that change. On the other hand, what we could be seeing, and in my more optimistic moments, this is what I think it is, look, it's a counter-revolutionary backlash against significant social change, but that change is coming, that change is for the better, and it's going to occur regardless. It turns out the backlash is much more virulent and dangerous, certainly than I predicted. You know, so back in 2008, when Barack Obama was elected, I thought, this is great. It signals a new America. Well, we didn't realize how angry the old America was. What do you think?
I think you're right about all of those things. What I'm worried about, honestly, is what happens over the next 7 days. Because, violence on election day is very uncommon in recent history, but was very common in the 19th century. There are riots that happen on election day. There are people who are killed on election day, before the Civil War, after the Civil War. That was, election day was a day of really profound, on occasion at least, very profound violence. And what I'm worried about is what happens next Tuesday. Inasmuch as we now have all of these mechanisms in place that appear to be acts of voter suppression, whether those voter ID laws or people being taken off the register, I can see somebody going and trying to vote and being told they're not allowed to vote, or large groups of people being told they're not allowed to vote. I could see people waiting in line. One of the things about sort of the American political moment right now is that the politics has become so bifurcated that, they don't s there is no sort of common identity as Americans that bridges these political divides. And I think people on the left increasingly see Trump supporters as illegitimate in some ways, and Trump supporters sometimes see people on the left as illegitimate. And I could see fights breaking out on people waiting in line to cast their ballots. And I'm worried about that. I'm worried about what happens when election results come in, and what the ways in which various people may respond to that. And I'm very much hoping that I'm wrong about this, but I've been worried for several months now about the kind of violence that Election Day might bring, and the events of the past week has only exacerbated those worries for me.
I mean, it would be naive on my part, particularly given the events of the last week, to kind of tell you you're wrong.
Tell me everything's going to be
Yeah.
okay.
On the other hand, I do think, I don't think that extreme Trumpist fringe is as big. Now, it doesn't take many people to cause a great deal of mayhem, but
As events of the last week indicate.
indeed. But I don't think that I'm here right now for the first time in 22 years, 25 years, for a prolonged period. And the vast majority of people are normal people leading normal lives. And I think there's probably more commonality than you think. When you follow the news on social media, you do get this bifurcated image. And I see that. And again, I don't want to push back too hard because the events of the past week have been horrible. But I'm slightly more optimistic than you are about that, I think.
Well, I
Let,
hope you're
let's
right
hope.
about I hope you're right about this, because I mean, one of the things that happens in the aftermath of a violent election, and you saw this happening with the Colfax massacre that we talked about, 20 minutes ago, is that when you have violence in an election and the election is classified as being illegitimate in some ways, what that culminates in is ultimately more violence. And part of the way in which a republic works is the people see election results as legitimate and are willing to live under the rules that the government creates in the aftermath of an election because of their legitimacy as being elected by the majority of the people. When people cease to recognize the government's legitimacy, things can spiral out of control pretty quickly.
Yes, they can. I mean, the danger might not be on election day. It might be in the aftermath of the election, whether people accept the outcome or not. Let me give you one little reason for optimism. I think in response to the bombing campaign last week, which thankfully was unsuccessful, one of the things we saw was particularly the FBI and the Justice Department did a great job of catching that guy.
Yes.
And
they did a better job with that than they did with the Kavanaugh investigation.
Yeah, okay. No. See, David, that's part of the problem. The point being that despite President Trump's efforts to delegitimize the FBI and the Justice Department over the past 18 months because he's got his problems with them, mm-hmm. and we saw a manifestation of that during the Kavanaugh hearings, in a moment of peril, they were – they did their jobs and seemed to have commanded the respect of the entire country while so doing. So I think institutions might be more durable. All of our institutions are under threat right now, but they might be more durable than they appear in the moment.
I also hope you're right about that.
Yeah, I'm clearly the more optimistic of the two of us. But
which is odd because usually it's the other way around. But everything over the past 2 years is you're looking for the silver lining. I'm seeing the gray.
So. Well, the most likable Red Sox team in history just won the World Series.
Pretty
good. So,
all right, Frank. I think it's time for our last drops. What do you got?
I went to a conference here in Charlottesville at Monticello of the American Academy of Diplomacy, and the American Academy of Diplomacy is a very, very interesting organization, and they have their own podcast, in fact, which I can commend to you. It's an organization comprised of retired American diplomats. Now, they are – each of them has to have – served. You have to be elected to this academy. Each of them needs to have been served at the ambassadorial level in at least two places. And I think the reason for this, okay. which is unstated, is that this keeps out the political appointees and the riffraff, as it were. So the kind of people that presidents when they make a car dealer the president the ambassador to Britain or whatever or in the current case the owner of the New York Jets, these people don't get into the American Academy of Diplomacy because these are professional diplomats who have served in some of the toughest places in the world. Anyway, I've attended a couple of these conferences over the years while I've been here, and I spoke briefly because the theme this year was self-determination and tribalism of this year's conference. And I spoke about Jefferson's thinking about these kinds of things. So they brought me in as a Jefferson specialist. The reason I would commend this institution to you is it's bipartisan. And these are incredibly serious people dealing with some of the most intractable problems in the world. The reason they're retired, they don't allow current serving diplomats in, is because so that they can speak more freely. But the understanding with a lot of them, I think, is that they're only retired temporarily. They may well be called back into service. Mm-hmm. It's quite encouraging to meet people who are very serious people dealing with serious problems in responsible ways. And I think that if many U.S. citizens recognize that the country was represented abroad by such people, they probably feel they might sleep a little bit better at night. But it's a very, very good conference. It's a very good organization. You can listen to their podcast even if you're not a two-time former ambassador.
limit their podcast audience.
That's true. It would be even smaller than ours. but not as smart. So it's just a very impressive organization doing some interesting work. Their website's interesting. Anyway, I want to give a shout out to the American Academy of Diplomacy.
How are they different from groups like the Council on Foreign Relations?
I think they're smaller, for one
Oh,
thing.
yeah, to be sure.
But I think they engage in some of the same discussions. Again, they come to Charlottesville, they come to Monticello every year for a relatively small conference, and they speak to both members of the public and to each other about a given theme. But I think they're similar to that. I mean, I will say that at dinner and over the breaks and so on, there was a great deal of concern expressed about the kind of undermining of the State Department under President Trump. But there was also some optimism that, there will be something afterwards. I will say a young woman got up and asked a question during one of the Q&A periods and said, "Look, I really wanted to work for the State Department." She must have been about 22 years old. "I really wanted to work for the State Department. I was going to take the Foreign Service exam, but then in the aftermath of the 2016 election and the assault on the State Department by Rex Tillerson, I just decided it wasn't worth it. What should I do?" And the response was, "Stay the course. There will be something after Trump. The State Department will be back. Besides, if you took the Foreign Service exam today, by the time you got a meaningful job, that's years down the line. So stay the course." And they were very, very encouraging to that young woman, saying, "Look, we need you now more than ever." So if any of our listeners are considering taking the Foreign Service exam, the U.S. Foreign Service exam, or the equivalent in say Britain, they should probably do so. Just don't be disillusioned by the current moment was the advice. You need to think in the long term, and I think that's good advice too. What about you, David?
So I want to make an endorsement for people local here in Edinburgh to participate in if they are so inclined. And it's happening this Thursday and this Friday, so November 1st and 2nd. It's a conference called Midterms and Mandates that's being organized by our friend and colleague Robert Mason, who is going to. It's the context is obviously to the provide some historical context for the upcoming midterm elections. And so it's a whole program of papers, most of which are focusing on the midterm elections in the 20th century. For people who like more modern history, there's lots of stuff on the midterms in 94 or in 2010 or stuff from 1970 or 1986. Always, I'm just looking here at the paper titles. There is going to be one paper that looks at all the midterms before that. But you can probably skip that one because that one's by me.
Hey, what? There's no plenary session on 1798?
No.
Oh,
So
my God.
they're having all the panels are post FDR, except for mine, which is everything from Washington to Hoover.
This is what happens when I leave the country, you
Yeah,
see?
so I get stuck with the all of the first 90% of American history. But that's fine. But it should be interesting, especially given there's some political scientists coming as well as historians, and so it should be an interesting mix of people thinking about midterms and what midterms mean in conjunction with the upcoming election next Tuesday. So it's Thursday afternoon and pretty much all day Friday. There's an event at the National Library. On the first event is a keynote there, but the rest of it is at IASH. So stop by for any and all of it that you can come to, and I'll post the program in the show notes.
David, what is IASH for our listeners from outside of Edinburgh
Okay,
University?
so IASH is the Institute for Advanced Studies in the Humanities,
Yes.
which is a organization that's part of the university. They fund events like this, but they also fund some wonderful fellowships for people to come and spend a semester here in Edinburgh and do research. So for people who are looking to come and visit us, this is one way you can facilitate that in the future if you're interested.
Excellent.
Great. Until next time, Frank.
Cheers,
Cheers.
David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.